We are talking about new opportunities on this, the penultimate live episode of 2025 for Musings on Golf. Kelly Elbin here once again, along with our executive producer, Jenna Self. Those new opportunities certainly apply to our special guest today, Brendan DeYoung, who has successfully moved from full-time PGA Tour player to full-time golf media member. We're also excited to welcome a new corporate partner to Musings on Golf in the Friars Golf Club, a traveling golf society for enthusiasts who love to play golf, who love to travel, and who love to make new friends at world-class destinations. You're going to be hearing a lot more about our good friends at the Friars Golf Club. Also talk a bit about, on the back end in particular, after the interview, about Scottie Scheffler and what this all means to have won the Jack Nicklaus Award as the PGA Tour Player of the Year for the fourth consecutive year. And really, for Scottie, what 2026 could mean on a larger scale. And I want to talk about a round of golf that I played last week that was very, very special. I mentioned that this is the next to last live show of 2025. Next week, PGA of America professional Duke Butler is going to be our guest. And while that name may not come to mind immediately, Duke is a master storyteller. Duke Butler, for 40 years, was intimately involved in the business of the PGA Tour. In fact, he ran the Houston Open, the very successful, what became the Shell Houston Open, for many years. And the stories that you're going to hear from Duke are absolutely fabulous. And then the last Tuesday of December, December 30th, we'll have an encore performance, encore show with Dr. Bob Rotella, which, as it turned out, was our most popular show of 2025. Therefore, we're going to play it for you again. And I understand why it was the most popular. People want to know, how can hearing from someone like Dr. Rotella help my game? And that was a tremendous lineup in a year filled with incredible stars on Musings on Golf. Let me set up Brendan DeYoung. The word that I'll use in a lot of ways is just respect. I always have great respect for people who come from another country, as Brendan DeYoung did from Zimbabwe, and came over, played on an American collegiate golf team at Virginia Tech, became real good friends, and to this day with Johnson Wagner, who is also someone who had a solid PGA Tour career, has made that move to Golf Channel. You see Johnson a lot. We had him on earlier this year. As a matter of fact, he and Brendan host the Wagyu Filet show on Sirius XM PGA Tour Radio. He'll explain why it's called that. Very humorous. But I just have a lot of respect for a guy like this, and a lot of respect also for him. He played in 317 PGA Tour events. He came close to winning. He didn't win, but he figured some things out along the way. And he's an affable guy, great personality, knows the game extremely well. You want to like Brendan DeYoung. Certainly the accent does not hurt him, but he got there first and foremost because of his playing ability. While he didn't win, he represented the international team on the President's Cup, paired with Ernie Els in four rounds, four different matches, one of which he gets into in depth when they knocked off the world number one at that time. And you could probably guess who that was. So you're really going to enjoy a lot of the insights from a guy who's been very well traveled, has a really sweet story about his dad caddying for him at the par three tournament in the one Masters that he played in. Big fan of Brendan DeYoung. Wish him very, very well. And he's very similar, right, to four other guests that we've had this year, four former players who've made that conversion from really good player to really good behind the mic. And that's John Cook. That's Rich Beam. I mentioned Johnson Wagner and John McGinnis, who also is on Sirius XM PGA Tour Radio. So enjoy, sit back, relax, have a lot of fun with this. It's really good stuff from Brendan DeYoung. And you'll hear that right after you hear from our three corporate partners with Titleist, William & Harry, and the Friars Golf Club. America, this is your moment. William & Harry's limited edition spirit shoe is here, so every fan can feel like part Team USA from the first tee to the final putt. two head-turning designs, premium deer skin, 100% waterproof with spikeless grip and all-day comfort. Limited run, don't sit this one out. Pre-buy now at williamandharry.com. Get into spirit. Get into comfort.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee. More control with your irons. More spin with your wedges. And more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. Well, from Zimbabwe to Blacksburg, Virginia, and from Augusta to Dublin, Ohio, the fascinating story of our special guest today reaches far and wide. He played in 317 PGA Tour events, coming ever so close to the winner's circle, and represented the international team in the President's Cup. Today you know him from his work on Golf Channel and SiriusXM PGA Tour Radio, particularly through the very fun and enjoyable show, the radio show that he co-hosts with another Virginia Tech Hokie. Hey, it's a real treat for me personally to welcome Brendan DeYoung to Musings on Golf. Mr. DeYoung, how are you?
I'm very well, Kelly. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I really look forward to this for quite some time. Thank you for joining us. And there's a lot of roads we're going to cover here, Brendan. And our show is all about great storytelling. And having listened to you and your good buddy, Johnson Wagner, through the Wagyu Filet show, I sense that storytelling is very much part of your DNA. So let's kind of begin with where you are today. You know, we've had some former players recently who's made the conversion from player to broadcaster, whether it's John Cook or Rich Beam, John McGinnis at SiriusXM, and they've been successful in making that conversion. I'm wondering, it's a big career change, obviously. I mean, you're all of a sudden your days as a player are over, and now you've made that decision to go in broadcasting. What was it like for you, Brendan DeYoung, to make that transition from full-time player to media member?
I'll be honest, Kelly, it was eye-opening. Obviously, you're going from this thing that you know so well. You're doing the same thing week in, week out. You're showing up at the golf course. You know everything. You know where everything is. It's sort of you know, it's part of your life. And then now all of a sudden you make this jump to the other side of it where you're in the broadcasting and you don't know anything. And I will say this, you kind of get thrown in the deep end and it's up to you, either sink or swim. And I think some guys have tried it and they figured out it's not for them. And then others have tried it and really have enjoyed it. I certainly put myself into that category because I'm loving it. But it certainly is eye-opening at first. You know, when we're playing, we don't understand everything that goes into putting on a good golf broadcast. We think it's just some guy talking about the shots we're hitting. We don't realize everything that goes into it. And I think that was the biggest thing for me, you know, seeing the magnitude of everything that it entailed to put on a successful golf broadcast. I guess the quick answer would be very eye-opening.
Yeah, and was it for you in terms of actually being behind the mic and speaking about golf as opposed to playing it? Was that relatively comfortable to do?
It was comfortable. Yeah, I think once you get used to having the voices in your head, I think that was the hard thing. You know, you've got a producer in your ear who's telling you one thing while you're trying to finish a thought. That to me was the most difficult at first. You get a little bit more comfortable with it at first. You know, the first couple of weeks, you almost catch yourself stopping and trying to answer the voices in your head, and then you get more comfortable with it the more reps that you get. But yeah, as far as just, you know, calling what I was seeing in front of me, yeah, I did. I got comfortable with that pretty quickly.
What was your first job on the other side as a media member as opposed to a player?
You know, my agent approached me, I think it was 2020, so it was COVID, approached me and asked me if I had any interest in doing this. And I said to him, I'm really not sure. I know my golf career is winding down. I'm not really enjoying the game. I don't know if this would be the best thing for me. He said, you know what? Do me a favor. Just go down to Ponte Vedra, St. Augustine at the time. Go down to the PGA Tour Live Studios. Go sit in there and watch what goes on and you know, maybe, you know, keep an open mind. And I did. I went down there, and I believe it was San Antonio of 2020. And I sat in there with Paul Stankowski and Gary Christian, who were calling the event at the time, and just watched the flow of everything. And I realized very, very quickly that I didn't dislike the game of golf anymore. I just didn't want to play it anymore. And I actually still liked to watch golf. So did that, and then I obviously didn't step on myself too many times, and they called me back to come and call one of the playoff events later on that year. So I think it was 2020.
Did you have anybody who kind of mentored you in a sense, who kind of helped you learn the ropes of broadcasting, if you will?
You know, Billy Kratzert, I would say, is one that jumps to mind. Fortunately, I'm actually about to call an event later today with Billy as well, which is fantastic. But he was the one that, you know, I watched Billy. I liked his style. He didn't use too many words to say what he wanted to say. He was very succinct, very to the point. So I would say if I was going to probably pick out one, it would be Billy Kratzert.
Brendan, I hinted through the opening at through the different country and cities that I mentioned. Yours is a most interesting story. You were born in Zimbabwe. You played collegiately at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. You played on a President's Cup team at Jack's course at Muirfield Village. You had the opportunity to play at Augusta National. And what was obviously very cool for you at the President's Cup was to play for Nick Price, your fellow Zimbabwean, and to play alongside with the great Ernie Els four times, I believe, in matches.
Yeah.
You won more than $11 million on the PGA Tour without actually winning an event. But we all start our golf journey somewhere, Brendan DeYoung. Give us a sense of how did you get involved with golf as a kid back in Zimbabwe?
So I came from it ended up being a golfing family. My dad was a very good rugby player growing up. Obviously, your lifespan as a rugby player stops fairly early. So he was about 35 when he stopped playing rugby and decided he needed something to scratch that competitive itch. So it turned to golf for him. Very quickly became a good golfer. And then I would just kind of tag along with my dad and older brother. And I was sort of the annoying little kid that would just try and go everywhere with them. Absolutely loved going out to the golf course. That kind of evolved to the point where my mom was comfortable enough to just drop me out at the course all day, you know, from sun up to sunset when I wasn't at school, and, you know, just sort of picked up the game that way. Then got old enough to where I actually could join my dad playing with him and his buddies and was allowed to sit in the bar and have a beer with them afterwards, which in Zimbabwe that year comes a little quicker than it does in the States. But that was sort of my early evolution in golf.
Did you pick up the game quickly and really well? And did you play any other sports as a kid?
I did, Kelly. I played a ton of other sport, actually. I played competitive tennis, rugby, and cricket, and actually was forced to make a decision between playing professional cricket and professional golf. I got offered a contract by the Zimbabwe Cricket Union when I was still in high school. I was actually at the golf course at the time, but the president of Zimbabwe Cricket Union showed up at our house with a contract, and my mom and dad were sitting there, and they just looked at him in the eye and said, "Listen, he's going to go play collegiate golf. This isn't going to happen." So that was a tough one. Obviously, the financial aspects of golf were a little higher than they were of cricket at the time. Plus, you know, the longevity of golf as well. But yeah, I did. I played a ton of other sport growing up. You know, Zimbabwe's it's a very, very proud sporting nation. That's kind of
our MO and has been for a long time.
What's the golf situation there in terms of, obviously in the United States, we have a massive amount of golf clubs. Are there a lot of private clubs? Are there a lot of public courses in Zimbabwe?
I wouldn't say a lot. You've got probably 15 to 20 of the, that are good golf courses. And I will say this, Kelly, they were always open with open arms would welcome in junior golfers. So that we had a rotation during the school holidays of five different golf courses where they would close the golf course and just allow the juniors to play for the day. So you have sort of free reign of the play and you know, not charge the juniors anything. So we had access to the best golf courses in the country and, you know, essentially free reign for the day. And that was, you know, how most of the guys cut their teeth.
I mentioned Nick Price earlier, two-time major champion. And I read where you said, Brendan DeYoung, that watching Nick win the Zimbabwe Open when you were a teenager really had a profound impact on your life. Talk a little bit, please, about why that was so significant for you personally.
You know, Nick at the time was number one in the world, and he always used to come back and made it a point to come back and play the Zimbabwe Open. And I, at the time, I think the first time he came back, I was 14. So I went out there and I walked with him, and these crowds, Kelly, were absolutely ridiculous. You know, obviously you've got this guy who's your sporting hero. Everybody in the country is going to get out there and watch him. And I just thought how cool it would be to play in front of these sort of crowds and, you know, where it's very obvious everybody is pulling for you. And then fortunately enough, I played in the Zimbabwe Open 2 years later when Nick came back and played another time and was able to sit down and talk to him for, you know, a good 30 minutes after I'd finished. And I don't remember if he won that year. I know he won one of the ones that I played in.
I think it also helps that Nick is just such a quality guy.
Oh,
and he's such a, right? And to be able to have that type of person, not only as someone you can look up to as a golfer, but you just said to spend a half hour talking with him, the effect that it has on you had to be just phenomenal.
100%. You know, we always talk about Nick Price, the golfer, but he is a better human than he is a golfer. And he really is. I've been fortunate enough to forge a wonderful relationship with him now. Got closer since I moved to the States. Always used to stay with him for the week down at the Honda Classic. And he really is. He's salt of the earth. I mean, just you want to talk about an unassuming superstar. He really is.
Very much so. Brendan, we had Illinois men's golf coach Mike Small on a few months ago, just before the start of the school year. Mike, just an unbelievable accomplishments at Illinois over the last 25 years. And we talked some about the recruiting process for an American university, bringing kids in from all parts of the world, really, to play golf in the States. For you, as a kid from Zimbabwe, how did you end up at Virginia Tech, number one? And what was the recruiting process like for you being so far geographically away from the States?
Well, I'll answer the second part of that first. You kind of rely on word of mouth as far as that goes. You're not obviously going to fly across the world to go and visit different campuses and stuff. So you're relying on word of mouth. And there was a pipeline into Zimbabwe Junior Golf from Virginia Tech where a couple guys had played there prior to me. So I was able to pick their brains. But the way we used to do it was the top two juniors at the end of the year of the Zimbabwe Junior Golf calendar year would get to come over to the States and play in the Ledbetter Junior, the Durrell Junior, and the Orange Bowl Junior. And that was kind of our opportunity to try and showcase what we had and hopefully get the eye of some of the college coaches. So we would be down in Miami, you know, for a good 5 or 6 weeks around Christmas time and play these three big AJGA events. And, you know, hopefully you got some decent results in some of those to where you've convinced a college coach to you know, take a shot on you, because you know it's a big gamble for a college coach as well. We were coming from Zimbabwe that at the time the currency was so weak as well that we essentially were relying on a full ride if we were going to come over and play collegiate golf. And fortunately for me, I got the eye of Jay Hardwick. As I say, it didn't hurt that there was a little pipeline into Zimbabwe Junior Golf prior to that, and I played nicely in a couple of those events, which certainly didn't hurt either.
Did you get noticed by other college coaches? Did you get other offers?
I did, yeah. I was fortunate. I won the Ledbetter Junior, so that sort of opened the gates to where I got some nice offers. But honestly, Kelly, it was an easy decision, more so for the fact that I knew a few guys that had played at Virginia Tech prior to that and all had wonderful things to say about Blacksburg.
And you had a really, really solid career in Blacksburg. to the point where in 2014, you were called and said, hey, Brendan, you're being elected as a member of the Virginia Tech Sports Hall of Fame. Man, what kind of a feeling must that have been for you to not only have, you know, attend that university, then be told you're going to be in their Hall of Fame?
Yeah, that was absolutely amazing. The only downfall there was that I was actually on my way to Malaysia, so I wasn't able to go and attend the ceremony, which would have been brilliant in itself. But I remember I went out and had several beers that night to celebrate it. I still think my collegiate career could have been better if I hadn't run into Johnson Wagner. But that's a story for another time, Kelly. But
That's your good buddy on the Wagyu Filet show. What, by the way, the Wagyu Filet, what's the origin of that? That's just a classic name for a show, a podcast, whatever you want to call it.
You know, my nickname, one of many when I was playing on tour, was Filet. And it came from Brendan de Jong Filet Mignon. A couple of the Australian caddies said they had come up with Filet Mignon, which got shortened to Filet. And then I believe Johnson was on Gravy in the Sleaze talking to Colt Nost and Drew Stoltz, and Drew started calling him Wagyu. So, and I think I happened to listen to it. So from there, obviously, this now evolved into this Wagyu Filet show. And, you know, it's been fun. You know, it was always going to be a lighthearted show. We figured we needed to have a name that was kind of going to match with that lightheartedness. So it worked nicely.
And you and Johnson seemed to have hit it off right away. Were you good friends right away at school?
Yeah, we really were. He was essentially my chauffeur for the first year of school. I didn't have a car when I was there for the first year. Johnson took me everywhere. I ended up sleeping on their couch for my first year. I didn't like being in the dorms, so I was in their apartment for the entire first year. We hit it off really quickly. We were fortunate. We had a golf team where everybody really got on well.
Hey, one more thing about Virginia Tech, just in general, Brendan de Jong, what is it like to adapt to a culture that is very foreign to you, to go to a big time large university in Virginia Tech, to be to go see American football and things that you'd never seen before, to eat different foods? What was that like for you?
Yeah, it's a great question, Kelly. And I will say this, that I was fortunate in the fact that I went to a small town. I think it made it that much easier. If I'd gone to a university in a big city, I think that would have been a very, very difficult adjustment. But the fact that I went to essentially what was kind of a rural small town in Blacksburg, it made that transition pretty, pretty simple. Plus the fact that, as I just mentioned, we all really got on well on the golf team, which, you know, it kind of made leaving home that much easier. It honestly was not that hard of a transition. Now, there were times when I certainly got a little bit homesick or struggled with things. I remember that first winter in Blacksburg, I'd never seen snow in my life.
Yeah.
And I walk outside one day and it's icing and snowing. I'm like, oh man, this is absolutely miserable. I remember we had a 6:30 workout one morning and I'm running over there to get in my car and I slip on the ice and bust my ass. And it was little things like that. But, you know, overall, as I say, was not a difficult adjustment.
So pleased to be joined by Brendan de Jong here on Musings on Golf. Your lone appearance in the Masters Tournament 2014, you finished tied for 34th. But I read something really sweet that you were on the Five Clubs bio area, which said your favorite experience in golf was having your dad caddy for you in the par 3 tournament that year. Obviously, any type of relationship between dad and son is special. Why was that so cool for you to have your dad on the bag for the day before you're playing in the Masters?
I knew what it meant to him, you know, just being around the event like that, where you're able to now get inside the ropes and essentially rub shoulders with some of the biggest names in the game. I also was fortunate enough to see the tee sheet, and Tom Watson was playing in the group in front of me in the par 3 contest, and then I was going to play with him in the tournament. And I knew my dad was a huge Tom Watson fan as well, so I knew that if we got to our tee a little bit early, he would be able to, you know, kind of talk to Tom Watson, which was I thought was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, just knowing that my dad's a huge huge golf fan, loves the history of the game, and this was just kind of sort of a thank you to him for everything they sacrificed for me growing up, you know, to give me the opportunity to play golf.
Sure. Had you had he known for a while that he was going to be on the bag? Had you asked him well in advance of that day?
He had absolutely no idea. So I
really,
I told him. I obviously the Par 3 contest was on Wednesday. I told him Wednesday morning that that this was the
wow. Play. Was that pretty emotional for your dad?
My dad doesn't show a whole lot of emotion, but it certainly was. I could tell that he was touched, and I mean, he just had an absolute ball.
I ask guys this a lot, and particularly guys who have only maybe played in the Masters a time or two. And you mentioned about playing with Tom Watson. Brendan, for you, Thursday, the first ball you ever struck at the Masters, to be on that first tee, what's that like?
It's nerve-wracking. It really is. You know, it's this tournament that you've put on this pedestal that you've watched millions of times. You know, you know that opening tee shot. You know every shot around that golf course, and now you're living it and you're doing it. So yeah, it certainly is nerve-wracking. And then now you're doing it in front of one of the greatest players to have ever played. Fortunately, I knew Tom Watson fairly well. He was married to a Zimbabwe woman, so we had that connection, and I did know him fairly well, which made it that a little bit easier. But yeah, certainly very, very nerve-wracking.
You talked to Tom? Did you have conversations throughout the course of the round?
Yeah, very much so. We did. We talked a ton. I asked him a lot of questions. I asked him a lot of questions, you know, just sort of reminiscing about certain shots that he'd hit to win the event and where he'd been in certain places. And then, you know, as we got a little bit deeper into the round Friday, we were both trying to make the cut, whatever. Obviously, you sort of step into your own world and do your own thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about that, the international team at the 2013 Presidents Cup at Jack's Place at Muirfield Village in Dublin, Ohio. You guys, unfortunately, did not come through with the victory, but you get to be paired not once, not twice, not three times, but four different team matches with Ernie Els. You won two, you lost two. I want to ask you about the last victory over a guy named Woods and a guy named Kuchar. Before that, what in the world, how great of a feeling to be paired with Ernie Els all four matches in team competition. What a thrill, huh?
Oh, it really was, Kelly. It was, I mean, I couldn't have asked for anything better. Ernie was absolutely wonderful. The way he took me under his wing, and he was still playing really well at the time, which helped as well. You know, the putter was a little bulky, but the rest of the game was so good. And as I say, he just made me feel so comfortable from the start. And, I couldn't have asked for anything better. And then I heard later on that Ernie had gone to Nick and said, "Listen, I found my partner. I'm playing with De Jong all four rounds." Which I mean, that made me just go through the moon. But we'd been paired together a couple weeks earlier in Boston at one of the playoff events, and I'd played nicely, and later I found out that Ernie from there had gone to Nick and said, "Look, I found my partner. We're playing together."
What was it like for you? How would you compare playing in a major golf championship such as Augusta National at the Masters versus representing an international team in the President's Cup and hearing your anthem?
Completely different feeling. You know, that obviously that team event and having grown up playing so much team sport, that was by far the highlight for me to get to play on that International President's Cup team. I had never had that much fun for a week of golf, and it's not even close, Kelly, to compare it to anything else. In saying that, the nerves were 10x as well. I was that much more nervous over that opening tee shot. Actually, I'll tell you a quick story that I had a 3-wood out to hit off the first hole at Muirfield Village. And I'm standing there next to Ernie, whatever, and he looks down at the 3-wood, and he looks back up at me, and he just shakes his head. And I'm like, what? Is this the wrong club? He kind of leans over to me and whispers in my ear. He's like, "When you tee up that ball over there, you're going to want to make sure you have the biggest head possible in front of you. You need to hit driver off this tee." So I'm listening to Ernie, whatever. I put the 3-wood back, grab the driver, and he was exactly right. As I bend over to tee up that ball, my hands started shaking. I was so thankful to have that big-headed driver in my hands.
Were your hands shaky? Were you that much more nervous than you had been anywhere else?
Not even close. Not even close. You know, we talked about the nerves off that first tee at Augusta. This was 10 times that.
And then, as you said, it was a fun week. Give us a sense of what's a team room like during that week when you guys are away from the grind once you get to the golf course. When you're away from that, What's it like, that camaraderie, among other things?
It's absolutely amazing. And we got robbed of a little bit of the experience just because the weather was so bad that week. There were a lot of times that we weren't getting back to the hotel and sort of until 9, 10 o'clock at night because of rain delays. But when you're in that team room, I mean, you know, there's guys that are sitting around telling stories. Everybody's having a couple beers together. And Nick Price did a wonderful job of welcoming guys' families into that team room as well. So it would start out where, you know, we would talk about the day's play and it would just be the team. And then he would sort of open the doors to where family members were allowed in there as well. So you got to know the guys' families really well. And I just remember the after party. I know we obviously lost, but the after party was fantastic, to the point where a couple of American guys had left theirs and all come down to hang out with us. But yeah, it really was just to get to know these guys' personalities a little bit more. Spending time with your heroes was really cool.
Oh, I bet. Let's delve a little bit into that last match, that foursomes match where you and Ernie beat Tiger and Matt Kuchar. Close match, obviously. What's that intense? It's a foursomes match. So it's alternate shot, correct?
Yeah.
What was that like, particularly down the stretch, those last 5, 6, 7 holes when everything's on the line?
It was amazing. So it was, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, we dealt with a lot of weather delays, and we were a couple up when we got called out, when we got called off for rain and had to finish it the following morning. I think we were 2 up through 9 maybe. Then quickly lost the 10th hole, but recovered very quickly. And I think we were maybe 3 up with 4 to go. And then Tiger does what Tiger does. He hit a 5-wood to 2 feet on 15, and they made eagle there. Then I quickly hit one in the water on 16. So we're all of a sudden just 1 up. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, Ernie was struggling with the putter at the time. But we managed to hold on to 1 up lead going up 18. I didn't hit a very good drive in one of those right bunkers. He kind of laid it up just short of the green. I hit a nice pitch shot up there to about 5 feet, and he was able to make a 5-footer to win that match. And it was really cool to see how much that meant to him. Obviously, Tiger had pipped him so many times, but now for Ernie to get just a little bit back on Tiger for us winning that game was really cool.
Brendan, you mentioned about the guidance that Ernie gave you to put the 3-wood back and hit the driver on the first tee. What's it like as far as just the back and forth between the two of you in a foursomes match like that? Is there a lot of talk down the stretch, strategy, among other things?
I wouldn't say a lot, Kelly. I think, you know, certainly this was our fourth match where we'd played together, and he was comfortable in that I was doing what I needed to do. I think there's certainly if you want to get back and forth and get into a lot of deep conversations, which some guys do, I think there will be that. We were both pretty happy to sort of do our own thing. And if there was something that you had a question with, you would ask the other guy, but essentially you'd do your own thing.
Hey, Brendan, you know, having played in a major international team event such as the President's Cup, it gives you a different perspective than many, many others. I want to get your thoughts on what happened at Bethpage as far as what continues to be just such a stout European squad with Luke Donald's leadership and Rory and the confidence that they play with and the passion and desire that they play with versus an American side that you know, the singles matches were great, but they were so far in a hole. What are your thoughts on what happened in general at Bethpage Black? And what does America need to do, in your opinion, to get back in the winner's circle starting 2 years hence at Adel Manor in Ireland?
You know, Kelly, I think first things first is they need to find some continuity. You look at the European team and their management setup and just their whole Ryder Cup setup as such. There's this continuity. You've got these vice captains that come back and are part of it, and you've got these vice captains that go on to become captains. It seems like with the American setup, it's sort of they don't really know what direction they're going to go. And then, you know, back in 2008, you've got this pod system that worked so well. So now why have you gone away from that? And then why is Paul Azinger not a big part of everything you're trying to do with the Ryder Cup? I mean, this is a guy here that's...
Big point.
This is a guy right here that's a proven winner. He was a wonderful captain. Why is he not involved in this whole setup? In saying that,
Keegan Bradley was put in a really difficult position as well. You know, he's this guy that's teetering. He's going back and forth. Am I going to be a captain? Am I going to be a player? And I realized that the closer that I got to this event, that it's impossible to do both. And the fact that Luke Donald is out there and he is just putting 100% of his time into being captain, and you've got Keegan over there who cannot do that because he's still trying to play. So I thought he got put in a tough spot by the PGA of America there.
I have had the good fortune of being the head of communications for the PGA of America for a dozen years, so I understand some of the workings that go on there. And it certainly was an out-of-the-box decision with Keegan. But I agree with you. It ultimately put him in a spot, you know, as much as he loves the Ryder Cup, and ardently so, he's had so many heartbreak that you kind of feel like, for goodness sakes, give this guy something, you know, maybe it's 2 years from now, 4 years from now, but something where there's a shining light at the end of what's been a rather dark tunnel for him, for an event that he holds in such high esteem.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, is Keegan ever going to qualify again as a player? We don't know. The fact that he really had a good opportunity to play on that team but didn't do it because he was a captain, that's a tough spot to be in. I didn't agree with it from the start that you, as the PGA of America, you go out and you pick this guy that's still very, very relevant in the game. You know, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And I'll be entirely honest with you, Kelly, it felt like a bit of a makeup call to me for the fact that Keegan didn't play on the previous Ryder Cup. So it was a tough situation. Obviously, they played very, very well in the singles to make it respectable. They need to sit down and they really need to, you know, I think start from scratch, break it all down. But they need to. I would look at the system that the European team has and follow that fairly closely.
Yeah, because it clearly has been a successful one. Hey, Brendan, before I get to the final question, I always like to ask about a dream foursome. I want to talk a little bit about kind of the vision of where the PGA Tour is going. You played on the PGA Tour, 317 events. Gary McCord is obviously someone who was intimately involved with the All-Exempt Tour when he helped put that together back in the day. He has some very, you know, clear thoughts as to what he sees, what he thinks could be the next iteration, if you will, of the PGA Tour. He sees it being divided into two divisions, similar to the way the Major League Baseball has with American and National League, the NFL has with the AFC and NFC and so forth. They play 18 events, 110-player field, 70-player cuts. And I've heard others say something akin to that. And it's certainly a major change in how we view the PGA Tour. How about your sense of what you see, and it clearly could be as early as 2027.
Yeah.
What do you envision a PGA Tour looking like starting, let's say, January or February of 27 after the Super Bowl is over that year?
Yep. I think you nailed it right there. I believe it's going to be after the Super Bowl. But, you know, you don't want to go against football. You lose if you go against football. It's massive. But I'll tell you what I think we're going to see, Kelly, is that we're going to see, obviously, with Brian Rolup, this word scarcity has been a word that has been used a lot. I think we're going to see probably a 100-man PGA Tour, and then your bottom under 100 is going to get swallowed up by the Korn Ferry Tour. They're going to essentially merge to where you have, you call it PGA Tour B if you want. And I think you may end up seeing a promotion relegation system where maybe your top 70 keep their card, your bottom 30 get relegated, your top 30 from the, call it what we want, PGA Tour B, come up. And I think we may see a promotion relegation system. And I don't think it's going to be a schedule of what we've got now. What is it, 45, 46 events? I think you're going to see maybe a 20 to 25 event schedule.
Well, I look here where I live in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, which was, you mentioned Honda Classic earlier, was home to Honda Classic for years. And Ken Kennerly and his team turned that into a massively successful event. Cognizant now runs it. As wonderful as it is as a community event, Brendan, I've got to imagine that the Cognizant Classic is probably very high up on the potential chopping block for PGA Tour starting in 2027. Events like that with smaller purses, They've got to be very concerned.
Well, they do, Kelly, and it's a shame because you're going to see some of your longest running events. I know this is the final year of Sony sponsorship. Got a good chance that we see Sony going away. Now Amex would fall in to where it's still inside of that Super Bowl window. So would Amex go away? Where would you start? It's going to be interesting, and I would imagine that these are all conversations that are going on right now.
Would you likely see, Brendan, that those events that are played would all have pretty much the same level of purses, that they would all be basically the same amount they're playing for that the elite players are playing for every time?
I think so, Kelly, and I hope so. I think that's the fairest model, right, where you've got every event is the same purse where, you know, obviously you go win one that's worth 10x of what something else is. You such a leg up. So hopefully we're seeing where all the purses are the same.
And Brendan, does LIV Golf just continue to be its own entity, or does anything get folded in at some point with LIV? Does LIV Golf have any interest in the DP World Tour? Where do you see that going?
Kelly, it doesn't feel like it at the moment. It feels like everybody's just kind of happy to go about doing their own thing. And, you know, we were told of all these talks that were ongoing, that's gone away now. And it doesn't feel like LIV's going anywhere. But in saying that, it doesn't really feel as though LIV's growing a whole lot either. So it's kind of an interesting one there. Are they going to go and try and make some big moves this offseason? Are they going to try and, you know, get a few more big name players to go over there? And is anyone willing to go over there? Just what they've seen from the product that LIV is putting out.
I agree with you. It's always fun for me to close these interviews with different people, whether players or other figures in golf, and ask the question of, you know, who would be the three people in a dream foursome with you? So I'll ask you that, Brendan DeYoung. Those three people, whether they're still with us or whether they're deceased, who would they be? Who would you have in a dream foursome, and where would you play that very cool round of golf?
It's probably one of your more generic answers that I'll give you, Kelly, but it would definitely be dad, brother, and son now, and we would play...
Yeah.
Wingate Park Golf Club, where I grew up playing, my dad and brother grew up playing, and give my son a chance to see where it all began for all of us.
How old is your son, and how much golf does he play?
He is just turned 14 and is starting to play a ton now. Really good soccer player. Out of the blue, decided he wanted to start playing golf. He's got wonderful hand-eye coordination. So it's been fun to watch him get hooked on this game.
Hey, Brendan DeYoung, it's been a real treat being with you again. So enjoy you and Johnson Wagner with Wagyu Filet and all the work that you're doing. It has been a transition, and you seem to really and truly enjoy what you're doing.
I really am, Kelly. I'm loving it. It's been a ton of fun. You know, obviously you're learning new things every day, but I really have enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to what the next couple of years bring.
Yeah, just keep Johnson Wagner in line as best you can, right?
I'll try.
Hey, Brendan DeYoung, thank you so much for joining us here on Musings on Golf.
Thanks very much for having me. Appreciate it. We'll see you soon.
Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G. For a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Brendan DeYoung, thank you very much. Really enjoyed the time with you. I hope that our listeners, I've got to believe they learned a lot more about who you are. And really, the storytelling is what our show has always been about. From the time that Bob Bupka and I initially started Musings on Sports, and then we segued into Musings on Golf, it's for guests like Brendan DeYoung, who not only have a great story about them, but are able to communicate and you know, give you the background on who they are and what makes them tick. So we really appreciate his time. Scottie Scheffler winning the Jack Nicklaus Award, becoming just the second PGA Tour player to win four consecutive PGA Tour Player of the Year awards, the other being Tiger Woods, who did so from 1999 to 2003. I still contend that, first of all, Scottie Scheffler deserves the award. But I still contend that Rory McIlroy had the biggest year. He finished off the personal career Grand Slam with the win at the Masters in the spring, and then he led, just as he predicted, he led Europe to the Ryder Cup triumph at Bethpage Black. In looking ahead to next year, this puts Scottie Scheffler in exactly the same position as Rory was this year. With a win at the U.S. Open next year, Scottie Scheffler would become the seventh to achieve the career Grand Slam. Do not put it past Scottie Scheffler to get that done. I want to close. I mentioned about Duke Butler joining us next week, and Duke is just so much respect as well for Duke and what he's done throughout his career. But I played golf with Duke and my friend Dennis Walters and my friend Phil Stambaugh, longtime media official who's now retired. Phil was on the Champions Tour for many, many years, did a great job on the media side there. We played at the Palm Beach Par 3, beautiful little golf course, and just watching almost the love that Duke Butler has for Dennis Walters. As you know, Dennis is the most inspirational person I know in golf, and lost the use of his lower body in a terrible golf cart accident in the early 70s, has gone on to produce more than 3,500 trick shot golf shows. He's a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. But this was the first time I ever actually played a round of golf with Dennis. And yes, he can drive the golf cart that he hits from. He can drive it onto the green. It doesn't leave any indentation at all. Setting up to just simply hit a golf shot and watching Duke patiently tee up the shot and put the ball in place for the putts. It was something I had never seen before. For me, it was very touching. We all just kind of take for granted that when we go out and play golf, we just go out and play golf. We get out of our cart, tee it up with the first tee and hit our shot and go back. It's so much more for that for Dennis Walters, and to watch it up close and personal, all the effort that he goes through to hit a golf shot, to hit a putt, and always keeping that positive frame of mind in place. It's remarkable to me. So it was a very cool experience to see that. He and Dennis have been friends for many, many years. They're very much involved in the Family Championship, which is an event that's coming up this week at Jacksonville Beach Golf Club in Florida. It's a big event on the Jacksonville Area Golf Association calendar, and something that's really near and dear to both of them, as well as my buddy Phil Stambaugh. All right, we have one more live show to go for Musings on Golf in 2025 with Duke Butler next week. For my elf, who's doing all the preparations in Houston to get ready for her Christmas, Santa, Kelly Elbin, signing off from very nice South Florida. Thank you for joining us on Musings on Golf.